We'll do some inflation. We'll do some economic indicators. And then we'll go out to eat. Sound good? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday today, the 26th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is going to be a week for those who like to keep track of this economy, present company included. The Federal Open Market Committee meets tomorrow and Wednesday, which means Chair Jay Powell is going to be taking some questions. Spoiler alert here, by the way, interest rates are not going anywhere. Also to come between now and Friday, the first reading on gross domestic product for the second quarter, that is growth on an annualized basis, April through June. The always interesting Case-Shiller Home Price Index as well, and the regular Thursday report on first-time claims for jobless benefits. Also on Friday, a reading on personal income and our choice for a lead story today, consumer spending. And with that spending number, by proxy anyway, a sense of how we consumers are feeling about this economy. It's important to understand, though, that that number is a snapshot in time. And the time that that snapshot was taken is not the economic and epidemiological time we are in right now. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra gets us going.
The numbers that come out on Friday will tell us what consumers spent in June.
That's the challenge with the personal spending data, is it's pretty lagged.
Andrew Dubinsky is senior U.S. economist at UBS. By the time consumer spending numbers come out, they're a month old. And in normal times, that's not such a big deal. But in a pandemic, with the variables of cases and vaccination rates and new restrictions, a month can make a difference. Like, maybe in June, a consumer wasn't worried about going to a concert or booking a vacation in another state. But in July, with cases rising, it's a different story. So Dubinsky says UBS has other ways of tracking spending.
We are looking at credit card spending data. We're looking at mobility data to track things like visits to, you know, retail stores or transit hubs.
So far, they're not seeing a drop in spending. But they have seen a change in consumer sentiment lately. In surveys, more people report that they're nervous about going back to the office or to public spaces. John Lear is chief economist at the research firm Morning Consult.
I can tell you that every day we're interviewing 6,000 people, and very clearly over the last 2 weeks, confidence has fallen dramatically.
And he says when consumer confidence falls, spending often follows.
Obviously, there are some things that people have to pay every month, your rent, groceries. But there's a decision that people make. Is now a good time to go out and buy a car? Is now a good time to take a vacation?
And that has to do not only with their job situation or how much money they have in the bank, but also how they feel about the economy and where it's going. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Here's a nice historical twist on all those supply chain stories we've been doing for a good couple of months now. Anyway, there is high consumer demand and limited supply. That much you all can probably recite back to me. You have heard it so many times. And you've heard a bit, too, about logistics backlogs, container ships lined up to get into the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. But the latest transportation hub beset by bottlenecks? Chicago. Railroads can't unload all those containers fast enough, so they are starting to stack up. Marketplace's Caroline Chaplin is on the Economic History is Cool desk today.
If you go to the Chicago History Museum, you're going to see a lot of trains.
You know, you really can't talk about Chicago history without talking about trains.
John Russick is the senior vice president of the museum and says ever since Chicago was founded, it's been about transportation, first by water, then by rail. And that makes sense. It pays to be in the middle of the country. These days, all seven of the U.S. Class 1 railroads pass through Chicago.
You might not think of it if you live in New Jersey or you live in California, but if you live in either one of those places, chances are the material that you've gotten has made its way through Chicago by rail.
And when container ships started backing up in L.A., overwhelmed by a surge in demand for goods from Asia, Ari Ash from research company IHS Market was already expecting a ripple of delays.
It was inevitable. There was absolutely no way to see what happened in Los Angeles and Long Beach and not have a situation in Chicago.
The situation is a backlog of containers waiting to get loaded onto trucks in Chicago. Some railroads have had to cut back on shipments to the hub and even pause them. Ian Jeffries, president of the Association of American Railroads, says at this point, with retailers already stocking up on holiday items, his members are expecting the crunch to last.
They expect this level of volume to continue through the end of the year.
If demand stays hot, Ari Ash from IHS Markit says shippers may look for another option altogether.
If you don't want to be in Chicago, you go to Memphis.
But Memphis is already backlogged, Ash says, and could quickly get as hectic as Chicago. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
Just a passing observation here that Wall Street seems, shall we say, not all that concerned with the state of the virus in this economy anymore. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, here is where this program takes a little bit of a turn. For, I'm going to say, 4 or 5 months now, the vibe about inflation and this economy has been, if not apocalyptic, then certainly fearful. And look, inflation is high right now, 5.4% in June over a year ago, the highest in a decade, and some prices were up more than that. Every hint that it's more than transitory, as Jay Powell and the Fed keep on saying, is met with a hiccup or two from the markets, sometimes more than a hiccup. But consider this. Maybe a little inflation isn't so bad right now. From our bureau in Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on the story.
People are paying attention to inflation right now. That's what consumer surveys say, and what I heard when I invited people in downtown Portland to talk about prices and wages.
It's so expensive. I've actually had, like today, like back off of things I normally would have bought. I was like, I don't want to spend $5 on tomato juice.
With the inflation prices that are occurring right now, it's kind of difficult to see myself being able to purchase a home.
Being the child of the 70s and 80s, certainly inflation was talked about. It is something that we need to be concerned about in terms of income inequality and people being able to afford basic necessities.
That's Dan Hagen, who's been working at a Salvation Army store and just got a layoff notice, Kendall Gordon, who works in mortgage finance, and Michael Freud, a supply chain manager. Now, runaway inflation can wreak havoc. Just look at Weimar Germany or Argentina. And it was bad here in the U.S. in the 70s and early 80s.
Those were dark times, and there was a lot of desperation there.
But economist Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union says today's inflation is nothing like that.
Inflation is higher. People are paying more for certain things. So if you have to buy a car or a house, but there's not general across-the-board inflation. I don't expect that to happen.
Because, he says, wages and prices aren't spiraling up out of control. In fact, Frick would welcome somewhat higher inflation than the Fed's current target of 2% a year.
If we got to a point where wages were pushing up inflation, even moderately, that's a good thing. That means finally the economy is running on all cylinders. And we have a lot of people in the workforce making money. That's going to expand GDP.
Yeah, but wages never seem to keep up with rising prices for things like food and rent and gasoline, right? Actually, wrong, says University of Michigan economist Betsy Stevenson.
People think that inflation erodes their purchasing power. On average, it doesn't, because on average, it raises wages as much as it raises costs.
That's how Portland resident Michael Freud's finances are rolling right now.
Both my wife and I have recently landed very good jobs, so we're not concerned, except for we'll be paying out of pocket for two college students next year, so we've got our challenges.
And 29-year-old Kendall Gordon's seen her salary more than double in the past 5 years, so she says she'll be fine.
As long as corporate America keeps up and cost of living is evaluated in salaries.
Gordon is worried about friends her age who aren't getting big raises and have student loans and car loans to pay off. But actually, some more inflation could be good for those folks too, says the University of Michigan's Betsy Stevenson.
Borrowers tend to be younger people in a lot of debt get helped by inflation. If inflation goes up higher than what people were expecting, well, then what you end up paying back to the bank is actually less in terms of purchasing power.
Older people and retirees, by contrast, tend to be savers, and they're much more worried about inflation, says economist John Lear at polling firm Morning Consult.
Seniors and older Americans are much more in touch with what's going on the price front. Anyone who's on a fixed income cares a lot more about inflation than people, let's say, who are working and expect some increase in their salary as prices increase.
The scary thing about inflation, according to the economists I talk to, is if everybody starts expecting it to stay significantly higher than 2%, the Fed's target, that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy, which could sow economic confusion and disruption for years to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
I was talking to my boss today about when we all might be coming back to the office, and without breaking any confidences here, I'm pretty sure that I can safely say the tone of the conversation was, yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's Delta, first of all, but also a lot of people at Marketplace and everywhere are reconsidering that whole got to go to the office every day routine. And as people who've been remote for more than a year start to reconsider their lifestyles, that becomes a business opportunity. More than 40 towns and cities across the country are offering relocation incentives for remote workers. That's according to Make My Move. It's a company that helps people apply for those programs. And we're talking anywhere from $2,000 to $20,000 in cash or housing assistance and assorted perks to sweeten the deal. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab, from her living room in Brooklyn, I think, has the story.
At the end of 2019, Cynthia Rollins was looking for change. She was tired of the cost of living in San Francisco and was starting a new remote job when she came across Tulsa Remote.
I applied really having no sense of whether or not I would ever actually move to Tulsa because I had never visited.
Then the pandemic happened, and not long after, Rollins was approved. Tulsa Remote, which is funded by a local foundation, gave her $10,000 to move to Oklahoma. She figured, why not?
I am enough of an adventure seeker where I could live any place for a year.
She thinks she'll stay, maybe even buy a house. There are programs like this in Augusta, Maine, Bemidji, Minnesota, Savannah, Georgia. Bob Ross is with Choose Topeka in Kansas. Incentives are funded by the county, up to $15,000, and the real clincher, free Jimmy John's.
If you actually purchase a home in one of their delivery zones, you do get an extra $1,000.
As in $1,000 in subs. So far, 43 people have moved. Ross says the town is seeing a big return on the investment. The average salary of workers relocating is $35,000 more than the local average. That's more income pumped into housing, recreation, and retail. Raj Chowdhury researches the future of work at Harvard. He thinks this is a great fix for places facing a declining population or economy.
Workers don't go there because there are no jobs. Then companies don't want to go there either because there's no talent. So there's a chicken and egg problem.
Chowdhury says communities need to invest in the internet and housing for programs like this to be successful. But he adds the pandemic has made a lot of people realize they want a different kind of life. And a little cash reward helps offset some of the risk that comes with making a big change. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
No matter where you are or where you work, if you miss us on the air, we got your back. We do a podcast. You can get it on the platform of your choice. Coming up,
the art and science behind menus.
Wait, you thought menus were just about the food? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 82 points today, about a quarter percent, 35,144. The NASDAQ picked up 3 points, next to nothing, 14,840. I don't know why that happens. S&P 500 pocketed 10 points, about a quarter percent, 44.22. A couple of months back, Jennifer Pak reported on the robust demand among Chinese parents for tutoring designed to help get their kids into the top schools. Now the Chinese government is cracking down on big tech companies that provide tutoring, and their shares are taking a beating. New Oriental Education and Technology, yes, before you at us, that is what the company calls itself, down 33% today. Tal Education Group lost more than 26%. Got a lesson today on what happens when a proposed merger falls apart. Two of the world's biggest insurance brokers, that'd be Aon and Willis Towers Watson, announced back in March of last year they wanted to hook up. Last month, the Biden administration filed an antitrust lawsuit opposing the merger. Today, the company said, yeah, never mind. Aon gained 8.2%. Willis Towers Watson went the other way, down 8.9%. 10-year, just to squeak it in here, 1.29%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is going to be hot in big parts of the country this week. It's been hot in a lot of places already this year, record heat waves, and it's going to keep on being hot because the planet is getting hotter. And increasingly, it's getting hotter in places that aren't supposed to be hot. See also 112 degrees in Portland, Oregon last month. And that eventually is going to hit workers hard. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Working the fryer at Jack in the Box can get pretty warm, even on a normal day. But when temperatures in the Sacramento area topped triple digits for several days in June, the kitchen got dangerously hot, says Noemi Graciano.
It was infuriating to be working like that. I felt uncomfortable because you're just sweating.
She grew dizzy and got a headache as the air conditioner failed to keep up. In Oregon, where temperatures reached almost 120 degrees in June, at least two workers died on the job of heat-related causes, according to state OSHA records. Kate Suzman is an attorney at the Northwest Workers' Justice Project, which has been hearing from people who work in construction, farming, and in warehouses.
So we had a lot of issues with acclimatizing your bodies, access to enough water to drink, shade, and even just knowing the signs and symptoms of what does heat illness look like.
The dangers of heat in the workplace go beyond heat exhaustion and dehydration, says UCLA professor Jisung Park. He's the lead author of a new paper which found higher temperatures were linked to more injuries at work.
Actually, the vast majority of the incidents that are caused by hotter temperature in our data appear to be completely or ostensibly unrelated things. So falling off of a ladder, being hit by a moving vehicle, getting your hand caught in a machine.
That's because heat affects cognitive function, too. The study found the risk of injury increased for workers outside and inside and was the highest in low-wage industries that require physical labor.
I think it clearly suggests that the scope and magnitude of the problem may be bigger than we're accustomed to thinking.
And as heat waves have become more intense, regulations to mitigate the dangers haven't kept up.
It's something people should have focused on a decade ago when it, you know, wasn't that bad. But now there's really an urgent need to do it.
Deborah Berkowitz is with the National Employment Law Project. She says OSHA has no federal set of guidelines for heat safety at work. Several states have created their own, including California and in recent weeks, Oregon and Washington.
Having a standard of what employers need to do in terms of acclimatization and hydration, you know, work rest regimens, I think will really go a long way in making the workplace safer.
The UCLA study found injuries associated with heat decreased after 2005, around the time the state adopted workplace heat rules. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
If you've been out to eat lately, like actually sitting down at a restaurant table in person out to eat, maybe a place you went to in the before times, you probably noticed menus are different now. The actual menus themselves, there's that QR code thing a lot of restaurants are doing, and you scan the code and pull up the menu on your phone. But also, what is being offered on those menus? There is a lot going on in menus right now. So imagine my relief to be able to get Sean Willard on the phone the other day. He is a professional menu engineer.
Menu engineering, it's the art and science behind menus. And it really pulls from a multitude of fields: behavioral economics, pricing strategy, revenue management, design, color theory. All these things play a factor in how we build menus that are easier for guests to navigate and then more profitable for the operator.
That's so interesting that you guys consider profitability. But anyway, we'll get there in a second. What I wanted to get you on the show to talk about, though, is what the pandemic has done to people in your line of work. Because menus, as we know, have changed both in form and, I suspect, in function a little bit.
Oh, yeah. 2020 was the biggest change to menus ever. And the primary menu has changed from maybe the handheld menu, yeah. Dine-in menu, has now gone to the digital mobile menu. Operators had to make this adjustment, very reactionary in the pandemic. And now we're here in 2021 and we can start to build our digital menus a little bit better with what we learned from the pandemic.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you about, you know, what you learned, because you sit down, you scan that QR code. First of all, what did you think when you first heard the whole QR code and people are going to read menus on their phones? What did you, the menu specialist, say to yourself about that?
People do not like looking at menus on their phone.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So the first thing that we work on with teams is making sure that they're formatting well for mobile. Then pictures is something that has really popped up. Oh, third-party delivery platforms have data that shows 50% higher conversions if a picture is shown versus not. So that's really a big difference there.
So I imagine that. Well, so first of all, QR code menus aren't going away, right? We can huff and puff, and you menu specialists can say it's not as good as the old days, but they're here to stay, right?
Oh, yeah. And they're a good thing. For many reasons, they allow operators to be more flexible in their offerings. We can change them almost instantaneously, and we're not printing hundreds of menus, yeah, that are one-time use being thrown in the trash or recycled bin.
In theory, we could have dynamic pricing too, right? I mean, if the, you know, beef stroganoff is selling really well, you could bump it up a buck and a half, you know?
Yes. And that is something that a number of different platforms are working on, that is how can they have dynamic menus that learn and become a little bit smarter as people use them.
Let me just say, on behalf of the dining public of America, I would like to vote no on that.
Yes, I'm in very much in agreement. You know, there's good things and bad things about it. And what it has to be done is, if price does go up, we just have to show that there is a time when price does go down as well. Maybe Monday or Tuesday, yeah, we might have some type of special.
Right. But also it could be that, you know, if you see the shrimp scampi on the menu in the old days and you really want the shrimp scampi and you order it and the server comes back and says, I'm terribly sorry, we're out, it would just stop appearing on that digital menu, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So when you go out to eat and you either get a QR menu or you get an old-fashioned paper menu that gets handed to you, is it possible for you to dissociate yourself from the actual process of designing that menu, or can you just sit down and have a bite to eat, man?
This is something that I have to work on actively, but it is something that I really do enjoy. I have a passion for it. So I love seeing a menu for the first time. And what I try to do as a customer is find what the restaurant wants me to have. Oh. So that's something we also work on with teams.
Wait, so what's the secret? How do I know what the restaurant wants me to have?
We have different tools that we can use. Boxes is one that's a very good one. But it's not just that. We can add descriptions and share recipes behind them if the chef learned how to cook it from his mother.
Do you really believe that when you see it on a menu, or you're like, oh, they're just blowing smoke, man. This guy didn't learn how to cook it from his mother.
You know, I think that there has to be truth in menus, so I would never fabricate that story.
Fair enough. Sean Willard, he's a menu engineer. Sean, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Kai. It's a pleasure.
This final note on the way out today, in which I eat some crow, but do not and will not eat macaroni and cheese ice cream. We told you about this a couple of weeks ago, a joint limited edition mac and cheese ice cream from Kraft and Brooklyn's Van Nuven Ice Creamery. It hit the streets on July the 14th, CNN reports, which it turns out, by the way, is National Macaroni and Cheese Day. Anyway, the stuff sold out like in a day, somehow. I am just going to chalk it up to morbid curiosity myself. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. Bitcoin popped today, up 10% after a rough couple of months. Why? I have no idea. That's kind of my point. Our daily production team includes Anis Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Honhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. It goes down, too. You know, Bitcoin does. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.